3.7% in February, 3.5% in March, 3.4% in April. So what's behind this recent steady decline in thriftiness? Economists say it could be about pent-up demand. After several extra years of holding on to that old car, some Americans may need or really want a new one. But it also could be that the necessities today remain expensive, while incomes haven't grown that much, and so people have to dip into their nest eggs to pay for health care, education, or transportation. Today in The Exchange, setting something aside, why Americans are doing less of that these days, and the impact on our wider economy. Let's hear from you. What do you think is behind this savings dip that we're seeing again? Are Americans, as a rule, just bad savers, or is that an unfair critique? What'll it take for us as a society to put a little more aside? Or are low savings rates our new American reality? Give us a call, The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email, the address exchange@nhpr.org. The Exchange is now on Facebook, too. We hope you go to our page, join the conversation there. With me in studio is Amy Schmidt, Associate Professor of Economics at St. Anselm College. And Amy, it's always nice to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for asking me again.
Also with us from D.C., Nevin Adams, director of the American Savings Education Council, a national coalition of public and private sector institutions committed to making savings and retirement planning a priority for all Americans. And Nevin Adams, good to have you, and welcome to The Exchange.
Thanks, Laura. Great to be here.
Well, and Amy, to you first, just first of all, why do you think these savings rates are dropping again after we saw a slight improvement, you know, 2 years ago?
Well, I think the improvement happened because of bad things. We lost a lot of wealth. The housing market just plummeted, and that's where a lot of middle-class Americans had their wealth. And when wealth goes down, people feel poorer, and they tend to pull back on their consumption. And really, savings is just not consuming out of your disposable income. It's what's left over. So when people pull back on consumption, their savings is going up. When people are really pessimistic about the future, they feel like they need to put some extra money away. When they see their neighbors being laid off, they are afraid they might be laid off next, so they're going to cut back on their consumption. So in a sense, the fact that people are saving less and consuming more, part of that is good news that people are feeling a little bit more confident about the future, that there's been some decline, not as much as we'd like, in the unemployment rates. And consumption is coming back. I think that we saw with the Great Depression a huge generational shift, but that was a much greater crisis with much more severe impacts that changed people's whole mindset for, like I said, an entire generation. I don't think that the financial crisis that we had has done that.
So the fact that savings rates have gone down again is partly good news, Amy. People feel a little bit better about the economy, and maybe we will take that vacation this year.
And we also saw the stock market come back quite a bit. We've seen housing values come back in some parts of the country a bit, and all of that leads to more spending and less savings.
Nevin, what do you think? Again, you know, after the rate hit about 5 or 6% during the worst of times, it's down to about 3.5%. Are you upset by that? Are you worried? What's your reaction, Nevin?
Well, I mean, I think anytime when you see savings rates go down, it's natural to have your eyebrows go up a little bit. To your point earlier, our savings rates when times were better, maybe even good, the savings rates were something that we pretty routinely held up to ridicule and said, you know, this is awful because, you know, people are just spending their money around. So to your point earlier, the good news is when times turned a little rocky, savings rates did go up. People were doing more about it. I think there have been some dynamics that have come along, and I think what's probably happened is two things. First off, I think people have been spending more. I mean, certainly gasoline prices, although coming back into some better territory, certainly spiked up quite sharply, and that was an issue. And I think, you know, people's feeling about the job market probably has a lot to it as well. The psychology of the comfort you have in terms of your paycheck continuing to come in, I think has a lot to do with how and in what ways you spend money.
Before we go any further, too, and there's so much to talk about with this, how do you, Nevin, define the savings rate? And I understand that it's savings as a percentage of disposable income, but these days, what exactly do we mean when we say savings?
Oh, you know,
we don't have savings accounts anymore.
Every time somebody wants to quote a savings rate at me, that's the first thing I want to know. Okay, what do you mean by savings?
Right.
I think this, the most common measures are just what you described earlier, i.e. there's how much money you're bringing in and there's how much money you're spending, and you take taxes into account on that, and basically it's sort of whatever's left over. And whatever is left over, I think Amy alluded to this earlier, tends to be sort of like the common sense of, you know, that saving. I prefer a little more scientific definition. Scientific's the wrong word, but the notion that money that is specifically set aside for some other purpose. Now, that some other purpose might be an emergency fund. It could be that car. It could be retirement. It could be for a house payment or something like that. But money set aside for a purpose. Other than that, it's just money in your checking account waiting to be spent. And I tend not to view that as savings.
What do you think, Amy? Does savings these days include, 401ks and stock market investments? Because these can vary dramatically over time. I mean, it's not an old-fashioned savings account where you put money in the bank and you get, 3%, 4%, 5%, 6% like it used to be, 20 years ago. So is stock investment really savings?
Well, I think that you're confusing a little bit the idea of savings and wealth. So, if I like to give the analogy of a bathtub, that the savings is the water, coming into the bathtub, and that's adding to your wealth, which is the water in the tub. When you retire, let's say, and you need to take money out of your 401k, that's money flowing out of the tub. So the money in your 401k, your balance, your stock portfolio, if you're lucky enough to have one, all of that is your wealth, part of your wealth.
That doesn't count as savings.
Savings, when we talk about a savings rate, we're talking about an annual rate of how much out of today's or this year's income you're putting away and adding to your 401k. So we're not talking about all of the 401ks in the United States. We're just talking about what's added to it every year. And not just 401ks, but as Nevin said, any money that's set aside.
I see.
When we look at the statistics that you mentioned before, we are including that money that's just sitting in a checking account or might just be sitting at home in, under your mattress. All of that counts as savings. Anything that isn't spent in any one year is counted as savings.
Nevin, did you want to jump in there?
Yeah, there's actually another point. It's an interesting point, too, as our population ages, as people sort of roll into retirement. I think the number I hear counted is 10,000 boomers a day rolling into retirement, which is a phenomenal number. But as people actually hit retirement age and people actually start dipping into their 401ks, spending the money that they've saved for retirement, and that kind of money sort of flows back in. What's interesting about some of the statistics is, that gets picked up as spending, as opposed to savings, and it nets against the perception of savings. So I think as the population gets older, as we enter retirement and we begin dipping in to some of these pockets of wealth and or savings, I think we probably want to keep a fresh look at some of these historical measures, because I'm not sure they take those kind of dynamics into place when you end up with that many more people spending in retirement as opposed to accumulating or saving for retirement.
Join us today on The Exchange as we look at the savings dilemma. We're looking at the savings rate here in the United States, how it's gone up and then again down more recently. Join us with your questions or comments, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. What do you think is behind this recent savings dip that we're seeing again? Are Americans, just as a rule, bad savers? Is that a fair critique? If we are bad savers, why? And what do you think it'll take for us overall as a society to put a little more aside? Our number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send us a short email, the address exchange@nhpr.org. Also, The Exchange is on Facebook, so we hope you go to our page. Join the conversation there. Amy, one or two more questions about, again, this definition of savings. It seems to me that there used to be a lot more vehicles for savings. We had banks called savings and loans that would offer nice savings accounts, Christmas clubs, vacation clubs where you could save up for big purchases. It just seems like there aren't as many options out there for people who want to do old-fashioned savings.
I think that banks are still offering a number of those alternatives. The problem is, of course, is that interest rates are close to zero. You know, there are some online banks that are offering a whopping maybe close to 1%.
Wow, that is really low.
Many local banks are offering just a fraction of a percent on savings or even on money market accounts. There's not a lot of incentive there as far as putting your money away and hoping to get a nice return on your investment. So even though the vehicles are still there, the rate of return is so low that a lot of people kind of feel, I think, what's the point
What's a saver to do then?
I think that the old saws about putting money aside every paycheck, rain or shine, if you can, is the best thing that you can do. That even though rates are low now, if you get in the habit of adding, one day rates will be higher, and then you'll have that money there and it will be accumulating. That it's better to start saving early for retirement. The younger you are when you can save, the better. There are still some tax advantages to saving. So, if you can afford it, it is helpful to do it early and regularly.
Even though the rates
are awful right now.
All right. Well, we will talk a lot more after a short break, and we'll start taking your calls, too. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also go to our Facebook page. Join us there. 1-800-892-6477.
You're listening to The Exchange here on New Hampshire Public Radio. Coming up at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show, victims of childhood sexual abuse often keep silent or wait years to report the crime. What the case against former Penn State coach Sandusky can teach us about protecting children and helping victims recover. That's the topic at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show here on NHPR. Where support comes from you, our members, from the Currier Museum of Art in Manchester, presenting the first museum exhibition of Eric Aho paintings, details at currier.org, and from Brewster Academy in Wolfboro, an innovator in secondary education where students live, learn, and lead in a college preparatory school environment, brewsteracademy.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, America's changing savings habits and their impact on our wider economy. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. As we look at the recent decline in our national savings rate, what do you think is behind it? Are we as Americans just lousy at saving, or is that an unfair critique? And what do you think it will take for us overall to learn to put a little more aside? Or do you think low savings rates are just a new American reality? Join us with your thoughts, comments, questions at 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Also, The Exchange is on Facebook. We hope you go to our page. Join the conversation there. Our guests are Amy Schmidt, Associate Professor of Economics at St. Anselm College, and Nevin Adams, Director of the American Savings Education Council. And both of you, let's go right to our callers. And Tanya is calling from Bedford. Hi, Tanya. You're on the air. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. Thank you for having me this morning. This is my story. I'm a 40-ish woman whose parents had her later in life. So my parents actually grew up during the Great Depression. They were first-generation American. So my husband's joke about me is my parents lived through the Great Depression, and then they made me live through it.
Oh. So what do you mean by that, Tanya?
Well, I mean, I am a huge saver. I make sure that my husband contributes the full amount to his 401k, including his over 50 catch-up. I make sure that we put money aside every month into a portfolio account, a brokerage account. I do a financial, look-see with my financial helper about twice a month. I use coupons. I cash in my spare change for my vacation account.
Wow.
I get, like, anxious if I feel like I'm spending too much money. I call it spending money like a drunken sailor.
Uh-huh, even though you probably aren't, Tanya. Well, and is this okay, Tanya? I mean, do you appreciate this about yourself, or do you wish you could loosen up a little bit?
I'm not as bad as my parents were, so mm-hmm. I feel like I am making improvement. But, you know, lately I've been feeling it's a really good thing, because when the economic downturn happened, people were feeling very stressed out, and I oddly felt very exhilarated.
Right.
Like, if anyone has the skill set to weather this storm, it's me.
Tanya, like, it's great to hear from you. And Nevin, what do you think? I'm real interested in this sort of cultural, generational approach to savings that Tanya talks about.
No, I mean, that there's something to that. My parents got through the Great Depression, and unfortunately, I'm probably more of a traditional boomer. But it was always really important for my parents. They put a lot of emphasis not only in having a mortgage, but in terms of having it paid off. Whereas, you know, today it's more likely to see people just kind of roll these things over. What Tanya's describing is I think a really good thing. I don't know how you sort of imbue that in people who haven't gone through that. We don't seem to be seeing that carrying over. You know, you can make an argument that the millennials coming along now have been given a taste of what the Great Depression might have felt like because of the financial crisis in 2008 and that sort of thing. But A, that wasn't as bad. B, it hasn't gone on as long yet. And C, they're still working off of something else. So doing the kinds of things that Tanya's talking about, I think, is a great discipline. I think setting a money aside, we were talking earlier about savings accounts and then not earning much interest, but I think it sort of defeats the purpose. It's great when you can get a nice return on your savings, but it's about setting the money aside so that you can dip into it later if and when you need to. It shouldn't be about doubling the return on your money, because that's where people get into trouble.
I see. And we all have that mindset, though, negative. You know, I just don't want it to sit there. I want it to make a little something for me. You're saying, you know, if it just sits there, that's good, too.
Well, it is. And see, the problem in some respects is there was a time when it made a difference to, let's say, move your money from your checking account to your savings account because, you know, it was in a separate place. You could see it separate. It generated a higher rate of return, a noticeably higher rate of return. Anymore, we've sort of flipped that around where there's not really any financial advantage, or doesn't seem to be any financial advantage, to having the money out of your checking account where you can easily spend it and tap it into with your debit card and things like that. There's no real advantage to putting it off somewhere separate. I think that tends to make the bookkeeping a little sloppy at a household level sometimes, because it's in your checking account. It's where you spend from, not where you save off to.
Well, and thanks a lot, Tanya, for that call. The number 1-800-892-6477. You know, to you also, Amy Schmidt, other demographic differences that you notice when it comes to saving. Tanya talked about, you know, her Depression era parents. Nevin mentioned the millennials, meaning people age 18 to 30. What other demographic differences do you see when it comes to our attitudes towards saving?
Well, in general, what we see, what economists have noted is, in fact, someone got the Nobel Prize for this, is that over the life cycle, savings change. And it sounds pretty commonsensical that younger people in general tend to go into debt. We know that student loan debt is even higher than credit card debt these days, so we see that that's happening. And then during your middle years, your prime earning years, people tend to accumulate savings during that time and add to their wealth. And then when they retire, they take that money out, as Nevin was saying. And so as the demography of the United States changes, as we become an older and older country, we have more people retiring, and we're going to see the savings rate decline as a result of that alone, even if nothing else changed.
Well, and I did see, again, Nevin mentioned millennials. I did see a survey by Bankrate.com that said that this generation of millennials are slightly better savers, Amy, than baby boomers, given what they've seen in this financial crisis. They're being a little bit more, you know, 6 or 7% more careful about savings. I found that real interesting.
I find that interesting, too. I do know that there is a push going on in high schools and in colleges to try to do more about financial literacy And maybe that's having some payoff.
All right. Well, maybe we'll hear from some younger people who call in and let us know what their peers are thinking and saying about saving. Our number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email us, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, the number, 1-800-892-6477. And let's go to Donald and Keene next. Hi, Donald. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. One thing I wanted to talk about was when I was growing up in the schools, and you know, we invested in United States savings bonds, you know, and I mean, for 30 years afterwards, I bought bonds because I got in the habit of it, you know, and now that I'm retired, I'm cashing a bond every week for the next 30 years, which is very good for me. But I used to give the bonds for birthday presents and gifts to my children and now to my grandchildren. And now that they've gone paperless, I mean, you really don't have anything to hand them. And I mean, I know there's at least a dozen people that I know that aren't buying bonds anymore for their grandchildren and children. And it gets them into the savings habit, too, just because there's nothing to actually hand them.
Right, right. So there's not as many good options, Donald, as there used to be. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct. I mean, I'm retired now, and I've invested some of my money into TIPS, Treasury Inflation-Protected Securities, because I'm more concerned about inflation than making a lot of money right now, you know?
Right, right, especially given what we've seen in the stock market. Great point, Donald. What do you think, Nevin?
Well, it's actually something that, being here in Washington, I've heard a lot of talk about. Obviously, there is to Donald's point, we used to do that as well, and it was a nice thing to do, and they looked really nice. And it's just nice to give something tangible. There has been a lot of reaction to that and the fact that it's basically all online now. It is a little harder in some ways to give people those bonds than maybe it used to be because of needing to set up an account and things like that. The good news, though, particularly I think when it comes to doing that for younger individuals, though, is that they, I think, are more in terms of an online environment. So, you know, very much in the day when, you know, you might hate to give gift cards or things like that, or, you know, now it's something online, so they can have an online account, they can see it online, and honestly, they're probably more, you know, keen on that kind of access and being able to check it out all the time than we were. So I guess I would say that it's probably a little less fulfilling for the gift giver, but probably just as nice for the person who's getting the gift, getting the online account, and able to keep up with their account.
Well, and Amy, we talked about this before, but Donald raises the point that, you know, again, if you want to set something aside and you don't want to put it in the stock market, given the ups and downs that we've seen, he said he's found an inflation-protected type of investment. So, no, he's not, you know, possibly making 20%, but he's also not going to lose 20%.
Well, actually, there's a negative rate of return right now on TIPS. You do, unless inflation does go up, you will lose money on TIPS. So Donald is, as he expressed, he's worried about inflation. He believes inflation's going to go up. So to him, it makes sense to buy those TIPS. But right now, inflation's running fairly low, you know, under 3%. You know, the hope is that the Federal Reserve won't let inflation get out of hand once banks do start lending again. And, you know, they do have tools at their disposal. They're talking about exit strategies to make sure that there won't be high inflation. But there are some people who are worried about it because of our national debt.
Well, Donald, thanks for the call. Again, the number here in the exchange is we talk about Americans' savings rates and how they've gone back down again after climbing up mid-recession. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And Nevin and Amy, here's an email from Lois in Charlestown. She says, I think that people can hardly be expected to be setting aside savings when so many people are behind on their mortgages. Wouldn't most people have emptied their savings of all sorts to save their homes in the last few years rather than spending it on consumer items or just not being good at savings at all? It seems to me that's where the money meant. Lois, just to let you know, we are doing a program on foreclosures tomorrow related to this idea of people trying to hang on to their homes. But for today, Nevin, what do you think about Lois's point?
I mean, I'm sure there are a lot of people in those kind of situations, and I've got some friends who have been in exactly that, who have had to dip into their savings to deal with their mortgage payments and things like that. So, yeah, you know, clearly people who are in those kind of situations, and you're having to make a choice between the setting aside money for a rainy day and the reality that you're right now in the middle of a cloudburst. So there are those kind of trade-offs being made, and people are doing that. I would say that for people who aren't yet dealing with that reality, though, those kind of situations ought to serve as a wake-up call, because the thing that has made a difference to a lot of my friends who've been in those kind of situations is they had the savings set aside that they could dip into. And I think the problem with human nature is we tend to sort of forget that day might come home for us to have to deal with it, and we don't have any money set aside. So if you're not yet in that situation, this is the time to be thinking about setting money aside in case that does come up.
True Ricker posted on the exchange's wall, and I want to share this with you. True says, personally, I find it's hard to remain motivated when savings accounts earn less than 1% interest, especially knowing at that rate, savings accounts actually lose value. And you talked about that, Amy. True says, certainly spending behavior has become ingrained, and I don't think any of those changes would last long term once the immediacy of the brink of disaster were passed. But here's the point I want to ask both of you about. True says, it's a conundrum, though, isn't it, that the economy needs to grow for the working class to do better, and it grows best when people spend, despite such behaviors not being the most responsible. True, that's what economists call the paradox of thrift, right, Amy?
Well, yeah, the paradox of thrift is even more extreme, where everybody saves. You know, saving is good for one individual, but if everybody saves, then the economy declines, and then you could even end up with less in savings in total if the economy declines enough. But this is a great point that is being raised, because before the financial crisis, most economists were saying we needed more savings. Savings finances investment, private investment by firms, and that's what gives us more capital stock. That's what makes workers more productive. That's what gives us more economic growth, that and technological change. Big breath there. You know, we had the financial crisis hit, and all of a sudden everyone is saying we need spending. So we really have a contradiction between what the economy needs in the short run, which is more consumption, more spending.
So go to the restaurant.
Exactly.
Go to the hotel.
Exactly. Buy local, all those good things, and what the economy needs in the long run. So most economists, I'd say a consensus, and that's saying something for economists,
that sure is,
are saying that this is not the time, let's say, to have big budget cuts. This is not the time to, have an austerity movement like we've seen in Europe, and now they're back in recession. But instead, this is the time to plan for more incentives for savings. This is time to plan for reducing the budget deficit, which is part of national savings or dissaving in that case, for a couple of years from now, so that when the economy starts rolling again, we're already positioned to take care of some of the long-term challenges, but that this isn't the time to be concerned about building up savings.
Well, and Nevin, I want to get you in on this too, but real quick, Amy, so that's the national picture, but what about on the individual level? You and me, what should we do?
Well, that's
go
another
get the shoes?
That's another Well, I think every family, and of course I sit down with my husband and we talk about what to do for the future. Every family needs to look at their own position. I mean, I think it is important to have a couple of months savings in the bank for a rainy day, just in case you don't know what might happen. I think it is important to put that money away every paycheck, even if it's just $25 a paycheck, to have it debited and put right into your savings account or a money market account, and have that habit. Whether you can afford to take a vacation or not is up to you, obviously. And, you know, of course, we all want to splurge from time to time. I think it would be very grim. Unfortunately, some people have to go through many years like this of having to watch every penny. But, you know, every family really needs to ask what's best for them, I think, more than should I spend for the good of the economy.
Nevin, what do you think? The paradox of thrift, especially given, again, that you're director of an organization devoted to making savings a priority.
Well, yeah. Well, the thing is, I mean, it's a part of the whole picture, and I think spending's a part of that too. And certainly, we can all appreciate the macroeconomic effects of spending. And honestly, it's been, if you think about the Social Security, the FICA withholding holiday that we've had for the last 2 years, where basically money that was going into Social Security has now been sort of like, you know, given to everybody to a little extra in their paychecks, if you will, on the assumption that it would be spent. And now, of course, we're at a point where we're saying, well, we can't put that back where it was, because if we do that, then, you know, basically you're going to be draining money out of the economy and you're going to set us back into recession, all that kind of stuff. And so, you know, even at a national level, even at a macroeconomic level, we clearly are sending what really seems, I think, to normal people to be kind of a mixed message here. I guess my sense on all this is that you really need, on an individual level, certainly on a family level, you need to have a budget, and that budget needs to take into account, you know, the spending that you need to do and the spending that you want to do. And I think savings ought to be a part of that whole picture. So, you know, it's not that, you know, you only spend on what you need and not a dime more, and everything else goes to savings. Savings, like everything else, needs to be done with a plan, needs to have a goal. You need to have, I think, just for your own personal sense of comfort, you need to have a sense of why you are setting aside the money that you are setting aside for. And it can be short and long-term goals, but it's a part of the whole plan, not taken in isolation. You know, after all, let's face it, if we're not spending some money, even frivolously, what fun is life?
What do you think, Amy?
I agree.
Some people say the Chinese save too much, which seems impossible.
and we benefit from their very high. They save about 30% of their income,
which is amazing.
Yes.
10 times more than what we save.
And part of that is because they don't have good credit markets, so they have to buy all their cars in cash, whereas we get to pay them over time.
All right. We'll talk more after a short break. Take a lot more of your calls and emails. 1-800-892-6477. Keep it right here.
I'm Kate McNally. Join me for another round of live music with the Tupelo Public Radio Project. This time, I'll be joined by Lucy Kaplansky.
I fell into the burning ring of fire. I went down, down, down. Flames went higher and burned.
We'll be at the Tupelo Music Hall in White River Junction on June 22nd at 8. For tickets and information, visit the Folk Show page at nhpr.org.
Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, from the online MBA program at Champlain College, offering an online information session on Wednesday, July 11th at masters.champlain.edu. And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, providing online health tools and podcasts for a healthier New Hampshire. Information at dartmouth-hitchcock.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the ups and downs of Americans' savings habits, how and why we spend and save, and what this might mean for the larger economy, especially given that savings rates are headed downward again. Join us with your questions with a call at 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org, or go to my Facebook page. And Nevin Adams, Amy Schmidt, let's go right back to our callers. Michael's joining us from Portsmouth. Hi, Michael. You're on the air. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, yes. I don't know if you covered this already and started listening later. I think one of the big factors is the lack of real wage growth over the last couple of decades. I mean, I think we had some real wage growth in the late 90s, but outside of that, it hasn't been very much. And I mean, if you also account for the rise in housing prices is not accounted for in the CPI. I mean, the CPI uses the homeowner's equivalent, which is basically using rent as an equivalent of housing. But if you look at, if you analyze housing prices as a whole, that's gone up so much, I don't think wages has really caught up with the cost of living in today's society.
You know, this is a really important point, Nevin. He's right. Wage growth has been sluggish at best. So, you know, that's a factor when people try and decide to put some money aside, Nevin.
Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, I think that's a part of that, you know, sitting down and doing the budget. And obviously, I think, you know, every year you need to do it. Now, I know, you know, in our house, like everybody else's, you know, I wasn't budgeting for that sharp, steep increase in gasoline. and that, you know, was a problem. That money had to come from somewhere else because I hadn't figured on $4 plus a gallon gasoline. And even the mass transit costs and things like here are going up. So there are going to be those things that come up. I think, again, part of the plan is to have a plan, to have a budget, to have some things laid out, to have savings be a part of that. You may find that you know, your wages don't keep up with the other cost, and the money has to be redirected from other things. That may be a reality. With luck, that's a short-term reality, not a long-term one. But I think it's sort of a constant battle to deal with the household budgets.
Yeah, Michael, thanks for the point. And here's an email from Tom in Rye, who says, I believe your guests are missing the mark in not addressing the behavioral and societal factors that inhibit savings. Tom says it has little to do with the financially repressive, low interest rate environment, and a lot to do with our inability to delay gratification. Tom says this behavioral element started in the early 70s and was enhanced by the live for today mentality brought on by the 9/11 attacks and later the financial crisis. What do you think, Amy? This is an important point. Are we unable to delay gratification? We want it. We want it now.
Well, what really flies in the face of that, though, is the increase in the number of people going to college. And I don't think anything says delayed gratification more than going to college and putting off earnings, going into debt in order to earn more in the future. But I think that certainly there is more that we could do as a society to encourage savings.
And delaying gratification.
And delaying gratification. But of course, and again, to disagree with Tom a little bit, you're more willing to delay gratification if the interest rate is higher, if you know you're going to have a greater payoff for waiting. And with that payoff so low, you know, I think people are more reluctant to delay the gratification.
You know, Nevin, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, because the point that Tom makes in terms of the behavioral thing, I mean, I think, and somewhat to Amy's point, I mean, it is a trade-off. I mean, people do make trade-offs, and people, you know, there's all sort of behavioral science around the notion of the relative value people place to something that they get in the here and now as opposed to something they have to discount for something they're not going to get into the future, particularly if it's something like retirement that, you know, we can't even really imagine what that's like, so it's really hard to value that. But one of the more innovative things that's come on in the last several years, although it's not a brand new concept, but it's being adopted in more and more employers, is what's called automatic enrollment in 401k plans. Now, when I first started working, they didn't have 401ks, but we had plans that you could save in, and you made people like me wait a year to put money in to get the value of the match and all that kind of stuff. But if you're lucky enough these days to work for an employer who has a 401k plan, what they may very well have put in place already, because a growing number are, is this notion of an automatic enrollment. So what they do is, unless you tell them you do not want them to take money and put it into the 401k plan, they will put it in for you. They'll start you in at 3%, and many of them will start you at 3%, and then they'll move it up a percent every year. Why? Because statistics have shown that people sometimes just have a hard time getting started. Maybe they don't know how to make that trade-off, but if you sort of make the decision be, well, you know, we're going to do this for you, you can change it if you want, but we're going to make you exert a little bit of effort to pull back and not do that, then what we find is that most people stay with that decision. And so what that helps is it helps people save right away, primarily for retirement, but again, in the facility of a workplace retirement plan. And what we've seen in terms of projecting that out over 20 or 30 years is that's going to make a significant difference in terms of how much people save. And it is acknowledging some of those behavioral stymies that keep people from doing the right thing.
I hear what Tom's saying, though, Amy, in a sense, you know, 30 or 40 years ago, before you had credit card companies knocking at your door, if you wanted a dress, you put it on layaway. And mm-hmm. every week or month, you went back to the store and you put down another $10, $15, $20, whatever you had. So there was delayed gratification. Now you would just walk in, plunk down your plastic, and get the dress.
I think that is true. And I think that maybe even more to Tom's point is the idea of what's the norm in society, that if you see your neighbors are going on cruises, they seem, you always thought they made about the same as you, they live in a similar house to you, how can they afford these vacations? What, you know, are you being left behind? Are you being silly for putting money aside when everyone else around you seems to be spending? You're the odd man out. And as, you know, when that change seemed to come in the early 2000s, especially, and people started using their homes as ATM machines for extra consumption, I could see that you're going to be influenced by all of what your neighbors are doing, by all of the television commercials showing how easy it is to get cash out of your house and go into debt. You know, it has to play a role. I'm not a psychologist or a sociologist, but you would think that does have an effect. And the same way, when everyone becomes more frugal, and I remember during the worst of it, talking to small business owners in Portsmouth, just going and doing my shopping, that they were talking about the fact that people, for instance, weren't buying a second pair of eyeglasses, you know, that they didn't want to be seen as spending a lot of money, that they were almost ashamed to go out and make a big ostentatious purchase. I think now that we've gone past the worst of it, and in New Hampshire, the unemployment rate is just 5%, people are opening up their purse strings again.
Let's take another call if we could. And this is Mark in Moultonboro. Hi, Mark. Thanks for hanging on. You're on the air. Go ahead.
How are we doing today?
Fine.
I just wanted to state that I know a lot of people are saving money now in cash because they're not trusting the bank to hold their money for them. And I know quite a bit of people that do this now.
So more people are putting it under the mattress instead of going to banks.
They are. And I know a bunch of my friends are doing the same thing. They're afraid to put it into the bank. The bank will collapse. They'll lose their money, even though there's FTC in place, and they just don't trust the banks anymore.
Not feeling confident. Amy, you look like you want to jump in, and then
well,
Nevin.
Well, because I did want to mention the FDIC. You know, they have
the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation.
Exactly, and you're insured up to $250,000 in any one bank. So if you have more than that, you can always spread it around different banks. If that's your difficult position. If a bank collapses, you know, when we have had large banks need to be wound down, no one has ever lost a penny since the advent of the FDIC in the 1930s. So I really don't think that needs to be a concern.
Nevin, what do you think about that? Lack of confidence in the banking system, especially given what we saw in 2007 and 2008.
Well, I think there's a lack of confidence, and the banking system is there probably, and certainly there were some issues, and we keep reading about big to fail, and you know, in the last month, you know, J.P. Morgan $2 billion. I mean, that seems like a lot of money to most people. I mean, it gets treated as sort of like didn't even clip the quarter's earnings or something that much is how it gets reported. But it does get your attention. And people are also concerned about things like the stock market, for instance. And, you know, every other day there's something going on with Greece or with Spain or with something that at a high level you think shouldn't have anything in the world to do with the stocks that I've invested in, and yet it does. I think the confidence is an issue. I think people's confidence or lack thereof affects how they spend as well as how they save. I think that's a big issue. Your alternatives to sort of avoiding banks, I think, get to be a little dicey. I mean, you know, to Amy's point, you know, if you lose that federal guarantee, well, things are probably in a really, really, really bad way. And we've seen no evidence that despite a couple of those bank failures that people have actually lost their savings. So as places to go to keep your money, it's probably as good as you're going to find. The thing that I remember telling my friends long ago who were inclined to keep their money in a mattress under their bed is, you know, I would just remind them of, you know, there are natural disasters. There are earthquakes. There are fires. There are hurricanes. These things can do a lot of damage to money under the mattress.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. You know, I just want to briefly share with you two comments from our Facebook page, Michael and Scott, both making the point that they feel the reason the savings rate is going down is because wages are stagnant and life is expensive. So I know we talked about that earlier, but I just also want to thank Michael and Scott for posting their thoughts on the Exchange's Facebook page. A couple questions before we close out, both of you. And this one's for you, Nevin, and I don't know if you can answer it, but I'll give it to you anyway. The typical rate of savings in the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, was 7 to 10%. So that was our national savings rate for that long stretch of time. Now we talked about it's down to 3.4%. What, in your opinion, Nevin, is a healthy national savings rate? What's perfect?
Oh, I don't know what perfect is. And I would say this because there are so many factors to go into it. So I hate to sort of answer without answering, but I would say that how you measure what that number is matters, and honestly, your own personal situation and what you're dealing with, you know, matters too. And I think it gets hard trying to apply a fixed number like a national savings rate, given some of the major demographic shifts that have happened over the period of time we're talking about. I will say this, that when I see the savings rates that are published and the 3% whatever that you mentioned, and I bench that next to the average rates of savings that I see reported in terms of things like a workplace savings plan or 401k or things like that, those average savings rates are much more like the 7 to 10% that you talked about earlier. And I think what we've seen is we've seen data that suggests that when people have the opportunity to save in a workplace savings plan, they not only save are much more likely to save, but they're much more likely to save more. Now, obviously, some of that is because they have a job and they have a paycheck and they have an opportunity to do it. So it's a combination of all those things. So I guess I would say that I think that people given an opportunity to do the right thing and the ability, the financial ability to do it, I think are saving more at those historic rates that we look at and we say, oh, those are really great rates, you know, and now it's not so good. I think the challenge for us is the people who don't have that opportunity or maybe don't have the income situation now where they're able to do it. So I see plenty of evidence that people given the opportunity to do the right thing do, in fact, do the right thing and probably at a pretty good amount.
Well, and that leads into my next question, and I'll throw it to you, Amy. So given that if people have the opportunity, they will, as Nevin says, do the right thing, how much incentive do our political leaders have to encourage us to save? Given that, again, as we said, 2/3 of our gross national product is made up of consumption, not savings. So how much incentive do they have to get on the stump and say, I want you to go out there and save America?
Right. I don't think they have an awful lot of incentive to do that. And actually, if they wanted to do something about national saving, the place to do it would be the federal budget. Savings is savings, whether it's public savings or whether it's private savings. Some people talk about a consumption tax or a value-added tax instead of an income tax, which would only tax consumption and let savings, all savings, grow tax-free, not just special 401k type of savings. So there are policy proposals out there that would encourage more savings. But yeah, you in the meantime would have a short-term contraction as we got to a new equilibrium with less consumption.
And nobody wants that right now, especially right. In an election year.
Although if we had economic growth, it's easier to have both. If everyone's income's going up, you can have more savings and more consumption
right.
at the same time.
Yeah, Nevin, go ahead.
Or I was going to say, too, that the notion that savings is sort of money off the table is not completely accurate either. I mean, except in the case of the people who were putting the money under the mattress. That clearly is money not doing any good, not going anywhere. But the money that you save in a bank does get redeployed and does get invested, let's say, in the community or something like that. It's not just about making the guys running the bank rich. I mean, there is a sort of a physical turnaround. Similarly, the savings that you do, whether it's in a 401k or in a retail account, in a mutual fund, or whether you buy stocks or things like that, I mean, that is money going back into the economy. Now, at some point, if people aren't buying the products those companies are making, that is a problem too. But I think we have a tendency to sort of equate savings more like with the mattress effect and not appreciating the fact that money is coming back into the economy just in a different way.
You know, that's a really good point, Nevin. Yeah, go ahead, Amy.
Just one quick point, which is I absolutely agree. We use savings, like I said earlier, to finance investments so that money does get cycled through the economy. One issue right now is that big firms are not spending that money. They're not investing. And banks right now aren't lending out money. They're sitting on huge excess reserves.
So they're putting it under their mattresses instead
Absolutely.
Of us putting it under our mattresses.
That's right.
So here's a last quick question for you, Nevin. You know, your organization's roots, as I understand, go back to a political movement in the 1990s where our elected leaders did say, yes, America, you could save a little bit more. What incentive do you think today's leaders have to get out on the hustings and say that?
Well, there are plenty of them saying it. I think this, if you will, is sort of a schizophrenia here, is the sensitivity to the economy and the realization that, you know, it's easy to preach at people and say that they should be saving more, but it has a hollow ring when people are really much more worried about either getting a job or keeping a job that brings the money in, that gives them the latitude to do the saving. So I think it is it's a tough message for the political class to put out these days, just because, again, they realize that a recovering economy sort of is a better support for the savings message than just a, yes, times are tough, yes, you've got to hunker down, but you need to put some money aside somehow.
All right. Well, Nevin, thank you very much. Good to meet you. Good to have you on the air today.
Thank you much.
Nevin Adams, director of the American Savings Education Council, a national coalition of public and private sector institutions committed to making savings and retirement planning a priority. Amy Schmidt, good to have you. Thank you for coming in today.
Thank you.
Amy Schmidt, associate professor of economics at St. Anselm College. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Craig Martin. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our interns today are Claudia Camarino and Samantha Johnson. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange is now on Facebook. Become a fan of our Facebook page. You can learn more about upcoming shows, get extra links and material. Our executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoi.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoi, and tomorrow on The Exchange, the foreclosure fiasco continues. The housing market seems to be stabilizing, but foreclosures are still a major problem. Some homeowners who tried to negotiate with banks are now going to court, saying they've been unable to get help. Meanwhile, lenders say they are making efforts, as they are still wading through an unprecedented number of troubled mortgages. Email us at nhpr.org and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.